Welcome to the Currency.News podcast, powered by Investec. It pays to be curious.
Hello, I'm Ian Keown. You're listening to the Currency Podcast. Well, the IMF recently warned that the global coronavirus pandemic is causing an economic crisis, the likes of which have not been seen since the Great Depression in 1929. For Irish business, it's posing a greater challenge than even the financial crash of 2008. In our podcast this week, we're going to be looking at the economic fallout of what's occurring and the impact on major currencies. To do this, we're joined by Gerard Keegan, an expert in corporate and institutional treasury, and also by the economist Ronan Dunphy, both of whom work with Investec. Gerard, I'll start with you. Before the epidemic really escalated, where were we from a currency and an economic perspective as 2020 was getting going?
Good afternoon, Ian. I have completely different worlds, I would say. I mean, 2019 was a different decade, but it feels like it could have been decades ago, given what's happened in the interim. I mean, we had a reasonably positive outlook for the year at the start of the year. We were about to get a trade deal agreed, for phase one of a trade deal agreed between the US and China. So that had moderately boosted the outlook for global growth. Euro-dollar trading in a reasonably narrow range, which is kind of maintained for the second half of 2019. And on the Eurozone side, we had Christine Lagarde had just taken over as the head of the ECB. Her predecessor, Mario Draghi, had done kind of a bit of hard work for her in terms of getting a rate cut and increasing their asset purchase program across the line, leaving her with, I suppose, the unenviable task of trying to persuade national governments in the Eurozone to start boosting fiscal spending as the next phase of supporting the Eurozone economy. But both in the US and the UK, there was no major expectations in terms of central bank or monetary policy action on the horizon. And I suppose possibly the most surprising thing was in the UK, the pound seemed unstoppable. I mean, we had Brexit, it had shaken off any of the Brexit-related concerns that kind of had dogged it for the second half of the year. We had the January 30th deadline, where it was officially going to leave the EU, coming up a very short time frame for negotiating a deal to out a trade deal with the EU, and insistence on the UK side that they would not request any extension to that deadline. And even the resignation of Sajid Javid, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, failed to slow the pound from reaching lows in euro sterling that we hadn't really seen since immediately after the Brexit vote. So reasonably positive, by and large. The outlook was for slightly better global growth and a few good news stories to start the year.
Well, as they say, that was then and this is now. Everything across business, society, health has all changed when COVID-19 and the real emergence of it started to arrive. From your own perspective, how has it escalated and the impact on the markets and so on? And what impact have we seen so far?
Well, I mean, at the very start, I mean, a few of the early indications that there were some concerns over what was then an outbreak in China, I suppose the concerns were limited to how much will this drag on Chinese growth and will it be big enough to have or will it just be a blip on the radar or will it be significant in those terms? I mean, we weren't even looking at a potential. What we saw as the first stage to affect the Western economies, I suppose, was the impact on supply from China. And then obviously it expanded into something much more significant. But the early indications, I mean, we did see some of the types of risk indicators that you'd keep an eye on, the likes of your 10-year yields on US treasuries and German bonds, very safe haven assets, and the likes of gold. They appreciated moderately in early January as kind of the initial concern started to grow. And obviously as the outbreak continued and even when the lockdown was announced in Wuhan, the likes of, say, the price of oil and other industrial inputs such as copper, they would have started to slide lower. So there was early indicators there. But I mean, if you look at the currencies in general, like I said, euro sterling, which was kind of unstoppable, the pound was benefiting from a huge surge in confidence. And U.S. equity markets continued to hit all-time highs. And in fact, even after the lockdown was announced in Wuhan, I think we had 3 weeks of appreciation in U.S. equity markets until they peaked in the 19th of September. So all reasonably positive from a market's point of view until well into February.
And then we did have Gro, that turning point, I think, around the weekend of the 22nd and the 23rd.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, that was when I suppose the first indications came out that this was going to be a greater global issue. So what we saw over that weekend was that Italy had become the third largest hotspot. Obviously, it soon became the largest, but it became the third largest outbreak after South Korea and China. And they also suffered their first three deaths. And then in the US, we had 20 cases, but there was a major controversy over the number of states where no testing was available, which indicated that it could be a bigger controversy in the US. So that weekend saw an outbreak of cases outside of Asia. And then the next week saw equity markets really started to slide. And we saw one of the worst single week declines in the May, like the likes of the S&P and the US equity markets since the global financial crisis. So that was what really set everything off and kind of prompted the central banks to start to take action.
I want to talk about oil, if I may. We were hearing an awful lot about oil even before this crisis had emerged in relation to issues around OPEC. There was an awful lot of volatility in relation to it. What's your view on oil?
Yeah, funnily enough, I mean, if you look back at 2019 and if you look at where oil traded, it was a remarkably narrow range considering the year, well, considering what we've seen since then. I mean, if you look at, we had almost constant back and forth between the US and Iran and imposing sanctions. We had the biggest supply, we had attacks on Saudi facilities, which caused the biggest supply interruptions that we've seen. But the price of oil traded pretty much within a $10 to $15 range for most of the year. If you look at what happened now, as I mentioned earlier, that the price of oil had started to slide from kind of a high of around $68 a barrel for Brent crude oil at the start of this year, had started to slide on early indications that economic activity in China might be affected. And that prompted OPEC to call a meeting to try and kind of support the price, I would say. So they initially, and again, it was the same weekend of the 5th of March. So the OPEC meeting actually did come to an agreement to cut production by 1.5 million barrels per day. Unfortunately, that all fell apart when Russia refused to sign up to the agreement. And then that kind of escalated on the 8th of March, where it led the Saudis to increase production or announce an intention to increase production by 2.5 million barrels a day to punish the non-compliance by Russia and other members. So it was a totally counterproductive response. And obviously that was, I mean, oil had maybe dropped to around 40 to $50 a barrel. We saw a complete slide to very, very long-term lows down to the low $20 a barrel. Now, look, since then, we have seen an agreement, and it was a historic agreement on production cuts, which, I mean, so OPEC members cut production by agreed to cut production by 9.7 million barrels a day, with non-OPEC members adding close to another 5 million barrels a day. The problem is we've moved on so much now from what was originally an agreement on cuts to support the price, the much larger agreement now has been really to support the whole industry and to prevent long-term damage to oil infrastructure going forward. So it's a much more drastic need of these cuts. And you can see from the market reaction, I mean, we did see some initial price positive appreciation. Brent oil went up to maybe $35, $36 a barrel. We're back down to below $30 a barrel as we speak. And that's an indication that it probably, in the eyes of the market, isn't enough. First of all, some of the cuts will be delayed and won't come into force until May. We're going to see inventories rise right up until then. And the other half of the equation that we still don't have a clear line of sight on is how much supply is going to fall. So we really only have half of the information there, and markets are nervous, and the oil price is still reflecting that. So it would be difficult to see a recovery in the oil price until we know how big the demand is drop in demand is going to be.
We've seen, and I think you made that point there about uncertainty, and I think that's what we keep on hearing from so many people in business. Really is a tough time to be in business with all that uncertainty. One of the areas that we're seeing it is around currencies. From a currency perspective, Garrod, what advice are you giving Investec clients?
I suppose we have no single piece of advice that suits all of our customers. I mean, this crisis has been very difficult across the board, but it has impacted individual customers very, very differently. And obviously they have different, some of them are currency buyers, some of them are currency sellers, and it has affected different currencies differently. From a currency point of view, in terms of forecasting which currencies will appreciate and depreciate on the back of the crisis, it's almost impossible until we get more information about a few things, such as when economies will start to reopen, how much the economic damage has been, etc., how successful the central bank intervention and the government fiscal intervention will be in terms of easing the ability for companies to reopen. But by and large, I suppose there's a couple of things we would say, and we think the crisis has highlighted this rather than make it more difficult. The first, I think, we'd say the recent moves in the pound, where we saw sterling going from a very strong level before this crisis broke out to almost post-Brexit vote highs in euro sterling or lows in the pound. It shows how vulnerable the pound is to adverse risk sentiment. And this is very important, even when this crisis resolves itself, which it will. We still have Brexit negotiations to come, and there is still the deadline of the 30th of December where the transition agreement will end, unless the UK have requested an extension, and they need to request that extension by July, August time. If they don't request an extension, we've seen it before, July, August, very illiquid time for markets. You'd be adding a huge amount of uncertainty on top of what's already been added by this this coronavirus crisis. And we think sterling, the price action of sterling has shown how vulnerable it can be to a reversal in sentiment. So that certainly would be a risk towards the end of the summer if the UK don't request an extension. In general, we would say, I mean, we've seen it before with the global financial crisis. All the central banks have cut rates, and the currencies that kind of perform the strongest on the far side of these kind of crises is the central banks who start to normalize monetary policy first, so the countries who start to raise rates. It was the US last time from 2014 to 2018, that not just the raising of the rates, but the indications that the US would be the first to normalize certainly helped to support the dollar during that period. And I suppose the opposite is true, that the likes of the Eurozone, who were kind of slow to cut rates and were still cutting rates in 2014, 2015, and even right up until 2019, and the euro remained relatively weak. So the first country to get out of this and start normalizing rates should see their currency appreciate. And then from the eurozone point of view, I suppose, and this is ongoing at the moment, we saw the eurozone, the impact of the bailouts and the austerity that followed them following the global financial crisis had a major impact in terms of negative sentiment around the eurozone and the whole European project. They have an opportunity at the moment with the negotiations that are going on around risk mutualization and possibly corona bonds and joint debt issuances to generate positive goodwill from the likes of Spain and the population of those countries and Italy who've been badly affected by this crisis. But their latest agreement is still focused around the ESM mechanism, which was used to bail out countries during the global financial crisis.
We remember that well here.
Yeah, exactly.
We remember it well.
The one positive thing I'd say is Ireland have, I suppose Ronan will probably talk about this in more detail, but we're certainly not in the same book at this time around for various different reasons. But there is a negative, or there's a stigma attached to using the ESM that Italy and Spain and the southern countries are very wary of using it. And they also feel that there isn't, or there shouldn't be, the same blame attached to fiscal irresponsibility causing this crisis, which it hasn't. So they feel that there should be a more joined up approach to taking responsibility for stimulating all of the economies across the eurozone and getting them out of that. And if they can come up with an agreement, which generates goodwill towards the whole European project, that would be very positive and would support the Eurozone, and it would be a blow to the anti-Euro parties that have seen a surge in the last 5 or 6 years in the EU. The next big milestone there, having had the finance ministers' meetings last week, is the EU leader summit on the 23rd of April. So that'll be a very important one for us to watch for the future of the Eurozone.
And Gerard, from a customer point of view in relation to currencies, what's your take?
What we are saying to our customers, I mean, their circumstances have changed so much in the last few weeks and are continuing to change. What we are suggesting to customers and what we're doing ourselves, I mean, it is a very difficult time, but whether you're shut down or your suppliers are shut down or your customers are shut down, maintaining relationships is extremely important, and maintaining lines of communication at all times. I mean, with all of our customers, what we're saying is we understand that your situation is changing. We're here to help you. If there is something that has happened, that means that the contract you put in place based on forecasted cash flows 6 months ago, those forecasts have now changed significantly. Let us know if you think it might be less exposure or different dates, or in some of our customers have seen a huge increase in demand and an increased need to hedge. The most important thing is keep updating your forecast as much as possible. A lot of this stuff is kind of not quite best guess, but the markets are changing and the expectations are changing so often that it is an almost continual process. But the more information you have, the better placed you'll be to make the decisions. And also, like I said, stay in touch with your customers, your suppliers, your stakeholders, your financial institutions. And if anything changes, which could affect any contract you have in place, the best thing is to communicate that extensively and early with the people involved.
So positive lines of communication. Listen, we were talking earlier about oil. I just want to go back on the oil side, because clearly demand is falling for the aviation sector. It's having a dreadful time at present, but it's rising in other sectors. We're seeing lots of delivery drivers and keeping supply chains moving on the other side. What advice are you giving in terms of hedging against oil volatility?
See, I mean, it would be overall, it would be very similar. I mean, there are... The biggest thing, I mean, it might seem like oil prices are very attractive. And certainly if you look at the forward pricing in the market, it is expecting a recovery in oil prices in the not too distant future. So this could represent these lows in oil. If you're a buyer, certainly could represent a very strong opportunity to put hedges in place at very attractive levels. What we would warn against, and this goes for the currencies as well, is you don't want to be taking a punt, so only put your hedges in place for the activity you're confident you're going to need it for, if that makes sense. And that all goes back to forecasting, and that does get more difficult in periods like that. But for customers who have confidence in their forecasts and have been updating their forecasts, yeah, certainly there could be reasonably good opportunities to put hedges in place. That's not to say that we might not see oil move a little bit lower before this. Obviously, if the demand side is weaker than the market is currently pricing in, we could see oil. We thought an OPEC deal might boost us a bit more than it has, or for a longer period than it has. That hasn't come to pass. Markets are a bit disappointed. But if the demand proves to be weaker, oil prices could move lower. But that's not like you're hedging at levels that you're happy with and locking in certainty rather than trying to pick the bottom of the market. And that is important in times like this when markets are so volatile. It is a lot about certainty as well, rather than trying to get the absolute best price.
Gerard, so many businesses are struggling. Their cash flow has simply dried up because they've had to shut down or lock down their businesses. So they've seen reduced revenues. Many people have seen no revenues whatsoever. Can they at least expect a period of low interest rates?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, I would say, well, the central banks are doing as much as possible to make it easy for companies to continue to borrow to fund cash flows. Borrowing is the key word there. I mean, they are forcing companies to increase their debt loads. I mean, nobody's, well, not yet in Europe anyway, handing out blank checks. So it does mean companies will have an increased debt load. Some companies might already have had maybe have overstretched them, and it will make it more difficult for those companies to get back on track even when revenue does start to flow again. But yeah, I mean, the one positive we'll see, all of the major central banks have cut rates. Where central banks had negative rates, it kind of the sense is they couldn't cut, so there's no benefit to cutting any further. But all the other major central banks who did have room to cut have cut rates right back to zero or where they see the lower bound. Now, that doesn't quite translate directly to where customers borrow from or where consumers or companies borrow from. The interbank lending market has seen rates come down a little bit, not quite in line with the central bank cuts that we've seen, say, in the UK and the US, for example. And that's because, I mean, these measures do price in. There has been an element of kind of liquidity or an absence of liquidity in markets, which is being priced into the interbank rates. And obviously, there is an element of increased credit risk, which is rightly being priced into these measures. A lot of what the central banks have done, aside from cutting rates, has been aimed at reducing the funding costs for banks, which should make lending very cheap. So, yeah, it should all flow through to corporate customers. And you're right in that where we've seen previous financial crises, the one thing we have seen is it has taken central banks a long time to raise rates once they've cut rates. I mean, if you look at the US, who I mentioned earlier, were the first to start raising rates, it still took them 8 years from when they finished cutting rates to start raising rates again. And in the Eurozone, one of the big concerns going into this crisis was that they still hadn't managed to raise rates. We still had rates negative, that they wouldn't have any kind of ammunition to face a crisis if we did have a crisis. So, yeah, they've been very, very slow to hike rates. We expect a similar response on the far side of this crisis. It will be very gently, easy as it goes. And there's a range of other measures that need to be halted or unwound, usually before rates start to be hiked up again. And even then, it is at a very slow pace.
Now, finally, Gurowed, and I want to bring in Ronan in a second. I appreciate equities. You're not a specialist and it's not something you trade in on the desk. But nonetheless, we've seen a big correction in stock market indices around the world. When do you think it might level out or the big moves in relation to what's happened?
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the most spectacular things, I mean, the speed at which markets, I suppose, crashed, it was a crash, was spectacular, way beyond anything we saw during the global financial crisis. I mean, I think most major equity markets in the US, the UK, Europe, they were down between 30 and 35% in the space of 3 weeks, which was unprecedented, even when you compare it to the height of the global financial crisis. What has also been unprecedented is the speed and coordination of the response from the global central banks and the major central banks, and also the response from governments. I mean, what we've seen is, if you look at the US, where I suppose they wouldn't have a social welfare system. You've seen Republicans and Democrats move past it to announce some very stimulative fiscal measures there. It took a few days of wrangling, but they have been very supportive. And if you look at the Eurozone as well, if you look to Germany, who have been, I suppose they have opposed deficit spending for years and years, they've been very, very supportive, amongst the most supportive economies when you look at the scale of their measures compared to their GDP. So the response to central banks has been very positive. There's a few other things we'd say are positive. First of all, you've had the PMIs and the forward-looking sentiment data from the Eurozone, the UK, immediately following the crash. That was all very, very negative. What we would say is we saw similar data from China, who are probably a month ahead of us in terms of going into lockdown and coming out of lockdown. They saw that crunch in the PMI numbers a month early, and they've seen a recovery back to positive territory in March when everything else was dropping. So we would be looking at very closely the April PMI numbers, which are Thursday of next week on the 23rd, would be a very interesting barometer. But there is positive signs in how quickly the sentiment in China has turned around. The other positive, I mean, equity markets have rebounded. It's very hard to bet against major central banks when you see the level of the measures they're putting out there. The Nasdaq this morning is only 5% down from where it started the year, which is incredible. Now, obviously, there's a few tech stocks in there, such as Amazon, who have probably benefited from people working from home and then increased online deliveries and things like that. But in general, the markets have recovered quite well, which gives some comfort. The other point I would make, I suppose, we would still be a bit tentative about calling a low, both in the oil price and equity markets, and for saying we haven't seen the end of any currency volatility until we see a couple of things. One of them is some of the fresh data post-lockdown, the likes of your PMI, your forward-looking PMI surveys, your GDP data from Q1, which will show what the impact has been so far. On that point, I'd say Chinese GDP data for Q1 is out this Friday. That'll be very important. And we have the US and EU advanced Q1 GDP numbers out at the end of April. So they will be very important. The other couple of things we'd be looking at, I suppose, you'll have company earnings for Q1, and guidance for Q2 will be very big for a couple of major US and global companies. It'll be very important to watch that kind of data. And it would be very hard to draw a line under this kind of thing until we know when and how markets and economies are going to reopen again. And there is a positive in that those conversations have started to take place. But we would be wary of, a premature reopening of economies, which could exacerbate any second wave effects and force a secondary lockdown. So while it might not see the booming return and the immediate return, scaled down gradual return is probably preferable for the long-term benefit of global economies.
Okay, Guro, thank you very much for that. I just want to bring you in, Ronan. You're chief economist with Investec Europe. You've been looking at the main economic supports being offered to business from the Irish government, from the Irish state. What's your overview of the main initiatives that have been rolled out?
Well, we've seen a really unprecedented range of supports launched by government in recent weeks. Unprecedented, really, in terms of their coverage, but also the speed with which they've been introduced. Perhaps the flagship support has been the wage subsidy scheme, which is very similar to schemes that have been launched in other countries and which refunds employers 70% of employees' wages up to a cap, provided that those employees are kept on payroll, which aims to ensure then that the workers are quickly reinstituted once businesses are able to reopen. There have been other loan schemes and funding supports available to businesses to help with cash flow difficulties. There's the Working Capital Loan Scheme from the SBCI, the Strategic Banking Corporation of Ireland. This fund has been upsized in recent days to €450 million. There's also longer-term loans available from the SBCI. There's also there's a credit guarantee fund for SMEs unable to get credit, funding from Enterprise Ireland for firms who trade internationally, and loans also from Microfinance Ireland for smaller businesses with turnover of less than €2 million a year who can't access traditional funding sources. So there's a range of supports there. They do all come with their own terms and conditions, it has to be said. But the government has been fortunate in a way in that it's been working on Brexit contingency planning, and it's been able to quickly repurpose some of these schemes to deal with the virus outbreak.
And as you say, I mean, the scale and the response has been quite quick and quite hefty. But is it enough? Do you think there's any gaps in our arsenal? Do you expect more initiatives going forward as we get to a real sense of which sectors are worst impacted and the real damage that's been done to the economy?
Yeah, I think what we've seen so far certainly been very welcome first steps and will be critically important for some. And the speed with which the government has moved must be acknowledged in completely unforeseen circumstances. But as time moves on, I think we'll see these schemes amended and improved. The early take-up on the wage subsidy scheme, for example, has been lower than expected, and it's still being worked on for some sectors. And also the majority of the supports are by the way of loans, which help businesses deal with short-term cash flow and liquidity issues. But a lot of the businesses that we're talking about, they'll be dealing with lost income, not just deferred income, and taking on additional debt through these supports. This debt will need to be serviced and repaid, which could hamper future growth and recovery. So it mightn't be the ideal way of dealing with these circumstances, particularly when you consider this country's recent experience of high indebtedness in the economy. So it's a topic that we've seen the ESRI caution about as well, you know, supporting the economy and supporting businesses through additional debt. So it's something that we may see evolve over time.
You mentioned there about the wage subsidy scheme, and the numbers are extraordinary, staggering. Unemployment is simply rocketing. The area's worst hit, you know, what's your view on that? And how many people do you think are at risk, I suppose, of becoming unemployed?
Yeah, the numbers made unemployed over the past few weeks are really quite extraordinary. In February, if you go back before the outbreak took hold, there was about 120,000 people unemployed. We had an unemployment rate below 5%. And out of a total labour force of about 2.5 million people, 2.4 million were working. So fast forward just a short period, and we're now in a situation where more than 500,000 people are receiving the new pandemic unemployment payment, 533,000 at the last count. So this payment is separate to the regular unemployment assistance programs. It's been set at a much higher level of €350 per week. But in addition, we have tens of thousands on the wage subsidy scheme. So although it's unclear, though, what this number actually is at the moment, we don't have a clear figure, and it's probably moving on a daily basis. But if you just take the 120,000 unemployed before the crisis, add the 533,000 receiving the new pandemic unemployment payment, it suggests that the underlying employment rate is now above 25%. And the scale of this sudden increase, it's quite difficult to get your head around, really. It compares with peak.
It is massive, absolutely massive.
Yeah, peak unemployment in the last crisis in 2012 of 16%. Now, it's also worth noting that the official unemployment rate at the moment is still much lower, but the specific criteria used to measure unemployment isn't really designed for this type of situation that we have now. So when you look then at, you know, where that might go or the numbers potentially at risk, what sectors, if you look at the makeup of employment in the country, you can sort of see how we've reached these figures so quickly. We have about 800,000 people working in what you might call vulnerable sectors, so the likes of hospitality, construction, the retail sectors. Now, not all of these workers in these sectors will be out of work, if you think of the supermarkets, for example. But there's also then a proportion of people in other sectors that will be at risk. So you would hope we're at this stage, we're past the huge surge in employment, even though the numbers will probably still creep higher until businesses are able to reopen. And that's the aim of the government supports, both Ireland and elsewhere, that the majority of these people that have been made unemployed, that are out of work, will be able to quickly resume work when the restrictions are eased.
I think that is a key point there, that, you know, the world will get back to normal, because this is a global problem. It's impacting the entire world and not just Ireland. I mean, how are Ireland's key trading partners? What's their reaction been so far?
Well, we've seen relatively similar responses from most national governments at this stage, similar to what has been put in place in Ireland. The immediate focus, understandably, on the respective health systems, and then introducing short-term labour market and business supports to try and contain the economic damage, ensure that employment of businesses can bounce back as much as possible once the restrictions are eased. In a sense, it's too early for large-scale fiscal stimulus at this stage, given that large portions of economies are not functioning. There's no point trying to stimulate demand when the supply of goods and services is not there. Although the main exception to this, it probably is in the US, where the scale of its immediate fiscal package amounts to over 5% of GDP, including $600 billion of helicopter money or direct payments to American households. But probably bringing it back to Europe, perhaps the most striking response in Europe has been from Germany. The size of its package there estimated at more than €200 billion, or 7% of its GDP, with about €100 billion of these funds earmarked to recapitalize and buy stakes in companies that are affected by the outbreak. Now, it's really interesting, because up until this point, there's been an almost universal mindset in Germany against the use of the public balance sheet to stimulate its economy, regardless of the state of the economy. And tensions with the ECB have been mounting on this point before the crisis. Germany had been clinging on to its Schwarz und Null policy, which translates as black zero, or a firm commitment to a balanced budget. And as a sign of just how entrenched this mindset is and how proud they are of it, when Wolfgang Schäuble departed as finance minister in 2017, hundreds of his colleagues dressed in black suits arranged themselves in the courtyard of the ministry in the shape of a giant zero. So it seems like it's taken a crisis of this magnitude for thinking to evolve in the largest economy in Europe, but also probably a sign of how there's no going back. In a sense, we can think of a great dividing line in terms of pre-COVID-19 and post-COVID-19 economic and fiscal policy here, elsewhere in Europe. But, you know, as you said, it's a global problem and a global response is needed.
I just want to interrogate that idea around the public balance sheet, Ronan. My colleague in the Currency, Thomas Hubert, recently interviewed the former head of the European Central Bank, Jean-Claude Trichet, a somewhat controversial character in Ireland as a result of the crisis a decade before. He spoke about the need for the bank to support European businesses, but warned that someone would have to pay for it. He even used the phrase, there will be no free lunch. How do you think the ECB has responded so far?
Well, he's right, of course, and who am I to argue with him? But someone always has to pay. And I think there's broad consensus that it's right that governments and the public sector bear the greatest burden in the current circumstances, although ultimately that burden gradually transfers to private households and businesses and future generations over time through the tax system. Now, hopefully those tax systems are fair and equitable and progressive, but that's probably a discussion for another podcast. But in terms of the ECB response, I think it's been significant. I don't think it's been found wanting. It's launched a 750 billion euro bond buying program and spent 50 billion of this already in the first 2 weeks. It's relaxed its rules on acceptable collateral, introduced other measures to improve liquidity, and signaled that it would continue to evolve and act as necessary. And it still has, it's never used before program, the OMT program, or outright monetary transactions. That's still in reserve, and that gives it the ability to buy unlimited amounts of government debt of a particular country if that country got into difficulty in bond markets. Now, it hasn't been a seamless response. There was a short-lived wobble following a comment from President Lagarde in mid-March that it was not the ECB's job to close spreads, meaning to reduce borrowing costs. That didn't go down well, but it was followed up a few days later with her comment that there was no limits to the ECB's commitment to the Eurozone, which the markets have taken as the ECB standing fully behind national governments, and it will do its part to ease the financing burden as borrowings increase significantly from here. Now, we've seen the positive effects of these actions already. In Ireland, last week, our own NTMA borrowed 6 billion euro over 7 years at a cost of just a quarter of 1%, a bond sale that was also met with record demand from international investors. So the influence that the ECB has already exerted is coming through there. So I think the ECB certainly feels that it's doing its part, and I wouldn't really argue with that at this stage.
And what about the Irish Central Bank?
It does have a role to play, but it's probably not a leading role, given that monetary policy is now in the hands of the ECB, and the main domestic policy response will come from the government by way of short-term business supports and the significant fiscal response that we'll see in time. But, you know, that said, the said central bank has done some important things. It reduced the capital buffers that the domestic banks are required to hold. That's why these buffers were introduced, exactly for economic shocks, even if this one wasn't foreseen. So the central bank has said this reduction in capital buffers could allow the banks to undertake new lending of 10 to 15 billion euro to support the economy. Now, the banks themselves will probably feel that they need to strike a balance between additional lending on the one hand and being prepared to weather the approaching storm on the other. The central bank's also been working with the banking sector in introducing payment moratoriums on mortgages and business loans for those affected by the pandemic. About 5% of mortgage holders have availed of these payment breaks at this stage, but that number is still likely rising. So the central bank here, it's playing an important role, but there are limits to what it can do, really.
Yeah. There's been an awful lot of talk and debate and around the issue of corona bonds. Some people are in favour, some people are against, and it's almost dividing Europe. yet again. But what's your own take on this type of measure and the likelihood of seeing corona bonds actually being introduced?
Well, there does seem to be some momentum behind the idea at the moment, even if there's still significant opposition from a cohort of probably four countries. Now, the benefits are clear. They're low-cost, mutualized debt, presumably at negative yields in the current rate environment, and these borrowings wouldn't show up on the balance sheets of individual countries. But it's not a new idea. The idea of mutual bond issuance from Europe was there in the last crisis. Euro bonds were much talked about then, but the idea never gained real traction. But I wouldn't be surprised to see them as part of the European response this time, because we don't have this moral hierarchy problem that we had last time, when there was a strong blame game playing out between the so-called core countries, northern European countries that didn't want to assume the costs or responsibilities of what they saw as the profligate countries of southern Europe, and including Ireland in that case. Now, we don't have that problem now. The coronavirus and the economic damage is clearly not the fault of any country or any individual or business sector. So there's a clear argument that mutual bonds are a right and appropriate response, and would perhaps even serve to strengthen European unity and solidarity if they were introduced. Some countries still need to get on board with the idea, notably Germany and the Netherlands, but I don't think it's a huge leap to get there at this time, and certainly not as big a leap as it was during the last crisis.
Yeah. Finally, Ron, it is that idea around the differences between now and the last crisis, and so many Irish people are scarred as a result of what happened in 2008 and on, and the bailout and all of that, and the crippling austerity. We're in a different place, I think, the Irish economy this time around. We are in a crisis, but we seem, certainly from what's been going on the last couple of weeks, better placed to deal with it.
Yeah, we've certainly, from a public finances perspective, made huge improvements over the last, particularly the last 6 or 7 years. So it's that old cliche, particularly in finance, that this time is different. Well, you know, this time is clearly different. You know, we're dealing with a completely different type of crisis. But, you know, it's true that we sort of entered this crisis in good shape in terms of our public finances. We've been running budget surpluses for the last couple of years. Our debt to GDP level has halved in that 6 to 7 year period to below the European average, actually, even if that metric for Ireland is a little bit flattered by the multinationals' presence here. But, you know, as we saw last week, we can raise long-term debt at close to zero cost, which, you know, is certainly something that's completely unprecedented. And the ECB is also standing behind European countries. So public debt is going to soar. It's going to soar in Ireland, but also in other countries, but in a way unlike the financial crisis before. And it's not something in itself that we should be unduly concerned about this time. Certainly, you know, at this stage of the crisis, it's more important that we do the right things in terms of public health, firstly, and then setting about trying to repair the economic damage after that. Debt will certainly be higher for the country, and, you know, that will have long-term implications, but it's a necessary evil at this point.
Okay, Ronan Dunphy, Grode Keegan Bode of Investec, I want to thank you very much for joining me on this currency podcast today. For other podcasts, you can go to thecurrency.news/podcasts.
You've been listening to the Currency.news podcast, powered by Investec. It pays to be curious.